The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From outside. So this is our finance panel. This is where the rubber hits the road. This is where the folks that have the capital get to assess the projects and decide whether they're worthy of investment or not. So these are the folks that you want to listen carefully to, because they are the ones that are on a daily basis assessing these projects, figuring out which ones are the ones that are going to produce the best returns. And in a very indirect but nevertheless powerful way, influencing who the winners and losers are going to be. So without further ado, let's get started. Our first speaker is Jean-Luc Parc of Calvert Securities, and he's going to talk about venture capital.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Thanks, Jean-Luc, for the quintessential venture capital approach. Our next speaker is Scott Livingston, who is a principal at Livingston Securities. Scott?
No PowerPoints for me. So thank you very much, everybody, for coming. I was told that I get 10 to 15 minutes, so I'll take 9. And in that time, I'll explain to you a little bit about what we're doing and our position over the over the last 20 years in the market, and why the world is broken, and why the financial crisis didn't have much to do with the world breaking, and then how and why things are changing right now for the better. And I'm going to leave you with a very, very positive outlook. So just 2 or 3 minutes about me and my background. I'm the chief executive officer of Livingston Securities, which is a boutique investment bank focused on nanotechnology. If you Google my name or my firm's name with the word nanotechnology, you'll see about 100 pages worth of stuff. I've been on Wall Street for 20 years, focused on emerging technologies throughout my career. We were investing and having investors invest in the Internet when it was still called the Information Superhighway. We did the first biotech deals back in the late 80s and early 90s. And just to give you a little bit of perspective, I was a top salesman at Smith Barney and Shearson and a couple of firms in the early 90s, but then I joined a boutique investment bank called Cowen & Company in 1995. And Cowen & Company really was a key player in underwriting the entire Internet revolution. When Alan Greenspan talked about irrational exuberance, he was talking about that in 1996, and the markets doubled from where he was talking about that. We were there for the whole boom, and then I sold out at the top and got out while the getting was good. Then I joined Lehman Brothers. I sold myself to Lehman Brothers in 2000 and started to focus on nanotechnology in 2002, 2003, because I saw that there was a revolution happening in science that was going to outweigh everything else that's happened throughout history, and there was nobody there to cover it. All the boutique investment banks, the Cowens, the Alex Browns, the Robbie Stevens, all these little boutique firms that specialized in emerging technologies got taken over back in 2000, 2001 when the market busted. And there was nobody there to cover the next revolution that was happening. I quit Lehman Brothers in 2005 to go out and start my own firm. I sold my Lehman stock at $72 a share. And yep, you got. It's not about when you get in, it's about when you get out, okay? Since then, we've been focused on nanotechnology. A quick definition, a nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. A nanosecond is 1/1,000,000,000 of a second. It's just 1/1,000,000,000. In the early 80s, IBM discovered or invented the electron microscope, and for the first time, we were able to image atoms, see atoms individually. Well, as microscopes and tools have evolved, just like computers and everything else have evolved over the last generation, we've now developed the ability to manipulate and move atoms around. Under 100 nanometers in size, physics gives way to quantum physics. Okay, I was a poli-sci major, so you know we're not going to get too deep here. But physics gives way to quantum physics. Newton gives way to Einstein, and properties of matter under 100 nanometers in size are completely different than they are in the real world. Things like surface area to volume ratios, tensile strength, again, we're not going to get technical here, but these kind of things go exponentially higher and really become kind of space age in their performance. And the ability to engineer and manipulate and take advantage of these properties is the essence of nanotechnology. Now, what does that mean? They're making steel now where the steel is double the strength of existing steel, doesn't corrode for 200 years, and turns out to be a green and cleaner way of making steel as well. Energy storage, energy transmission, I got here for the Wellinghoff talk and have listened throughout. Things like energy storage, energy transmission, those kind of things are accelerating. And performance in those areas are accelerating. Things in healthcare and defense, every industry is being turned upside down by nanotechnology. And we have the leading investment bank that focuses on these kind of industries. And what I'll say as a general general overview here is that everything that you've heard today needs to be understood and thought about within the context of accelerating technologies. Moore's law has been a well-known thing for the last 30 years. Semiconductors double in price performance every 18 months. Well, as it turns out, semiconductors, silicon, are Moore's law may be the same in every other material as well. So the price performance of solar cells, the price performance of energy transmission materials, the price performance of all these different materials looks like it may follow a similar type of a Moore's law thing. And so the investments that we're making today and the policies that we're making today must take into account that there's going to be more technology developed over the next 10 years than there has been in the last 100 years. Literally. And that these technologies and all of these scientists and all of these geniuses are focused on energy and on infrastructure and on all these things more than ever. And so we see a very, very bright future for advanced technology, and we need to get from here to there. Now, I didn't come to talk about nanotechnology, and I didn't come to talk about emerging technologies. What I came to talk about was Wall Street, because Wall Street and venture capital are broken. And they were broken before the financial bust. Okay. Now, I was the solutions, the ways that we reacted to the NASDAQ bust in 2000 and 2001 created the problems that exist today. Big firms taking over small firms left a gap in small investment banks that cover emerging technologies. The push towards bigger and bigger mega funds and takeover funds and larger and larger and larger funds sucked out all of the oxygen out of the small entrepreneurs. Nowhere has that become more evident than the death of the IPO. Back in the 80s and 90s, if you were a company that was looking to get financing, a very logical step for you to do would be to go public. And going public gave you credibility in the market. You were audited. There was a certain level of quality that you were if you were a public company that was worth something to you in the business world and also helped you to attract and retain high-quality people. The decade of the 2000s has seen the slow but sure death of the IPO and certainly the death of the small IPO. And if I may say, companies like Apple Computer, Amgen, Amazon.com, eBay, these all started as little small IPOs, and they're the greatest companies in the world today. And so the death of the small IPO has had wide repercussions. One of the main repercussions that the slow but sure death of the IPO has caused is the, I won't say death, but venture capital as an industry is very much on life support. Most venture capital funds are in a distressed manner right now. There's talk that 50% of the venture capital funds that exist today could be out of business within a year. The reason? No IPOs. If you don't have an IPO market, if you're a VC, then you can't get out of any of the stuff that you got into. If you can't get out of any of the stuff that you got into, then you can't get into anything new. If you can't get into anything new, then all these wonderful new technologies that we're talking about wither and die on the vine. Don't listen to me. The National Venture Capital Association, the industry trade group for VC, based right here in the D.C. area, had their annual meeting in April of this year, and they talked about the VC industry in crisis. And they said that up to 50% of the VCs could be out of business over the next year. That's right on their website. They initiated a plan to reinvigorate small IPOs, And if you, I would suggest everybody take a look at that because it's very informative and important. The if you go to Google and just hit National Venture Capital Association four-pillar plan is the website, and it would be an interesting read for those of you who are interested in finance. This plan, this meeting shook the world because all of a sudden the venture capital funds started to focus on IPOs again. And in the summer, we've seen a resurgence of IPOs. And the IPOs are making money. Not all of them, some of them. There's certainly a trickle, not a flood, but a trickle is better than an iceberg. And filings are up, more capital is going into the field, more people are interested in new companies and new IPOs, and this could be a virtuous cycle which could break up the ice for finance for emerging companies. This is a very, very, very important trend. We need to do everything we can to get entrepreneurs and breakthrough technologies financed. The beauty of IPOs is that you and I can buy them, right? We can invest, and we can lose money and we can make money, but we can invest. And we can invest $10,000 or $5,000 or $1,000 or $100,000 or any amount of money that we want in these companies and bring them financing. And it's interesting because the days, in my opinion, the days of mega funds and computer trading funds and, you know, hedge funds that restrict your capital when they go into trouble, those sort of things. The days of investors blindly putting their money into investment funds, those days are over, right? NIMBY, I'm gonna make a new one right now. It's not NIMBY anymore. It's not with my money. What's that? NWMM or something? NWMI? Not with my money, buddy. Right? Investors want to invest in things that they can see, feel, and touch. We are constantly all over the country talking with groups of investors, telling them the greatest inventions, the greatest technologies are coming out of your local universities. Any university that's worth its salt has a nanotechnology program there with an entrepreneur, with a business plan, with a tech transfer department that's looking for capital. And the capital's coming from individual investors. The IPO is a way for people to buy and sell and be liquid. And if we have a vibrant IPO market again, this is the one major thing that we think will help breakthrough technologies succeed. So anything that you all can do, talking to your elected leaders, talking about policy papers, anything that we can do to encourage emerging investment in emerging technology, we need to do. And from my perspective, you know, we are very, very actively raising money for public and private companies that are commercializing these emerging technologies. And the future is extremely bright. I'd rather be America than any other country in the world. The crisis that we have in energy and in the markets right now has called the best and brightest of the world to action. And so when we think about all these policies that we're talking about and all of these public-private partnerships and legislative matters, what we need to remember is that underneath the surface there's a revolution happening in science and technology, and that revolution is the answer, and we need to encourage that revolution. Thank you.
Last but certainly not least is Peter Flynn, and I honestly can't think of anyone better to wrap up this panel for reasons that I think will be self-evident.
I think that's because he knows I can clear a room. Thanks, Roger, and thanks very much for having me today and for sticking around for the last guy. My name is Peter Flynn. I'm a principal with Bostonia Partners. We're a small boutique investment banking firm located in Boston, Massachusetts. We focus on federal, commercial, municipal, renewable energy, and energy efficiency projects. And I'm coming at it from a little bit of a different perspective. Todd Lee earlier spoke about tax equity. We've heard a little bit about venture. I'm going to focus a little more on the debt markets. What's going on with the debt markets, and in terms of credit spreads, we're going to look a little bit at U.S. Treasuries. I think they're a good indicator for what's going on with base rates as you're looking at project cost and project interest rates, a little bit about institutional buyers and what they're doing, if anything. Some words of advice around renewable projects, the outlook for those in the short to midterm, as well as some thoughts around structuring those projects. I was going to talk a little bit about a couple of federal programs that we're involved with where projects are getting done and are being financed in today's market. But in the interest of time and cocktails, I think I'll reserve that. If anyone has any questions about those particular programs, I'm happy to answer them. The current market environment, we've heard a little bit talked about it today. It's, things are not good. The markets, and I think this says they're not begin functioning normally. I think that term is used very loosely until the second quarter of this year. The capital markets really are only functioning at the current time for investment grade credits. And that push towards movement towards investment grade credits and actually monies and funds being put to work really didn't happen until the last quarter of 2008. Institutional investors have been sitting on the sidelines, sitting on a lot of cash, and it's been a significant flight to quality. If you're below investment grade, if you're got a lot of structure to your particular transaction, if you can get it done, there is a significant risk premium associated with your transaction. A couple of the other markets, I won't spend a lot of time on these. The junk bond market actually has been improving over the last several months, and by junk bond I mean below investment grade credits. Has been improving. We were looking at yields last year in the 20% range. They're down now. They're not to historically low levels by any stretch of the imagination, but things have been improving, but improving really for a sliver of the market. We're seeing very few of those deals get done. The CMBS market is wiped out. That market, most think, won't come back for years to come at this point. Wanted to talk a little bit about the U.S. Treasury market, in part because when we're talking about financing projects, those are typically done as a credit spread to an underlying base rate, whether that's LIBOR or swap or U.S. Treasury. And I thought it would be helpful to talk a little bit about U.S. Treasury. Some of the projects, certainly that we work with, are priced over the U.S. Treasury, and I'll typically be talking about the 10-year U.S. Treasury. We've seen over the last 2 years up until recently a rally in the U.S. Treasuries. The question is, has it ended? Perhaps not. We've seen an uptick in Treasury yields recently, but we're still below the high mark, or the average mark, actually, for 2008, which was, I think, at a 3.66%. So we're still below there. But there's a huge abundance of supply. Just this week, the government's selling $70 billion in U.S. Treasuries to finance all of the Recovery Act that's going on out there. One interesting note that we've noted in terms of who's buying these, primary bond dealers, folks who are required to buy and participate in U.S. Treasury auctions, are actually in a net short position with U.S. Treasuries, which means they're confident about the way the economy is moving and confident about the credit markets. Investors are starting to move away from some of these risk-free securities and in search of more yield. We're not back to 2006, 2007 by any stretch of the imagination, but they are looking for a little more yield out there than they'll receive from U.S. Treasury. One of the questions is, it's really been the government issuing this debt, and it's been the government buying this debt, as well as mortgage-backed securities. The question is, will the federal government continue to do this? Is this inflationary to issue so much debt and have the government purchasing the debt? The answer in the short term, at least, is it's probably not inflationary because you and I, as consumers, are not spending money, which is keeping inflation low and the risk of inflation low. This is just a little look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury over the past 2 years. As you see, since the beginning of the year, we've had a general uptick in yields, and this is yields which move inversely to price of U.S. Treasuries. They are up. But they are historically low. So the question for folks doing projects out there, if base rates out in the market are at historic lows, why is it costing more to get my project finance? Why is my all-in interest rate on my project higher than it's been ever? And why am I having difficulty securing capital? This chart helps to answer, and I'm sorry about all these charts. I know I'm at a law school, not at the business school, but I think it's helpful at least to sort of look a little bit at it. The bottom line in the green is the U.S. Treasury, which we just saw on the last slide. And the top two, the pink, is an A-rated corporate index, and the blue is a AA-rated corporate index. AA is one of the highest rating categories you can have. A is just a step below if you're looking at Moody's or Standard & Poor's. And credit spreads, as you can see, really began growing with, if anyone remembers, the credit crunch we were all talking about in the summer of 2007, which became a financial crisis in September of 2008. You can see where that financial crisis hit with the two large lumps there about September of 2008 and moving out. Interestingly, back in 07, you see spreads over the base rate. At that point, the spread was probably 5, maybe 10, 15% at the most of your credit stack. Today, the way credit spreads have moved, you're looking at 50% or more of your credit stack is the credit spread. This chart really just kind of demonstrates more recently, a more recent look at our last chart over the last 2 or 3 months. It shows that credits, the good news is that credit spreads are actually moving in. Cost of financing is starting to compress. Again, I'm talking only about investment grade credits, but really within the last 2 or 3 or so months, we've seen movement in of spreads at in the range of 70 to 80, perhaps up to 100 basis points for particular credits. This is another look. NAIC is a rating agency for institutional investors, and NAIC 1 is the highest category. It's high investment grade, A or better investment grade if you're looking at Standard & Poor's. NAIC 2 is still investment grade but low. That'd be equivalent of a triple B, low investment grade credit, not junk, but almost. Again, this just shows the ballooning in spreads. The blue line at the bottom is the 10-year U.S. Treasury. This is where we were back in 2007. Here's where we are now, and that's your spread. So it's ballooned out significantly. In fact, over the last year, spreads were out 200 to 300 basis points, and over the past 2 years, up to 400 basis points in these two categories. Institutional buyers, large institutional investors who traditionally have had a lot of money to put to work in the market for projects, whether they be renewable energy or energy efficiency projects, what are they doing? They were, as I said earlier, sitting on their money for a while. They're getting back in the market, as I think everyone has recognized. It's starting to loosen up out there. They're still feeling it out. This category of investors are extraordinarily risk-averse. They're even more so now. Not to get too heavily into sports analogies, but the strike zone has shrunk for these institutional investors. Their perfect deal is right down the middle. They're not going to swing at any outside curveballs on the edge anymore that they might have looked at back in 2006, 2007. It's difficult to get a deal done. It needs to be well-structured. You need good lawyers like Roger working on your deals, so they're well-documented. And that's how you're going to get deals done. Pension funds as opposed to life codes are still kind of sitting on the sidelines. There's a lot of view of that the fundamentals of the economy aren't quite back. We might see them get back into the game a little more consistently in 2010. Banks, they're with the steepness of the yield curve that has come back, they're in profit mode. So essentially what that means is they're lending high and paying out to you and me low. So they're making money. Which I guess is a good thing, but there's still no appetite with banks who, as Todd mentioned earlier, were the largest buyer of tax credits. They simply don't have the appetite for tax credits associated with renewable energy projects, so that remains a challenge. So in general terms, renewable energy projects, where are we? What's the outlook? I think in the short and medium term, as markets here are recovering, I think the outlook is positive. ARA has provided incentives that are helping to get projects done. The question is whether that can be sustained over the long term. We'll have to see. For instance, tax grants in lieu of tax credits is very helpful. We don't, if banks aren't buying tax credits, we've got a limited market for tax credits, whether they be ITCs or PTCs. It's helpful to get the cash grant from Treasury. You simply apply, and you get the same 30% you'd get for your tax credit. The problem is that you still need to take, for the economics of these deals, take advantage of accelerated depreciation, which is another, essentially you need the same type of buyer who can take advantage of that depreciation. That legislation did nothing to resolve that issue, so that's still a challenge for many of these projects to get done. That can be a significant part of the economics in making these projects work. One of the other, I think, positives is that there are new funds being put together as we speak that are targeted towards green investments, green funds. That doesn't mean, to stick with my strike zone, that their strike zone is widening for those projects. They still want yield, and they still want well-structured deals, and they still want investment-grade credits. But they are looking at the sector and are making a commitment to the sector, which I think is critical. A couple of thoughts. Only sound projects with quality participants, strong cash flows are going to get funded in this environment. You need investment-grade credits for your EPC, your construction, for your ongoing, any kind of ongoing operation and maintenance, and your offtake. Your power purchase agreement needs to be with a strong credit if you're going to get something financed in this environment. And you're also looking at lower leverage. We're out of the days of 90% leverage for these transactions, and higher debt service coverages than have been required in the past. A few thoughts just generally around deal structuring for those of you working on deals out there. Obviously, remember that institutional investors, the folks you're looking at for money, are in defensive mode. Folks are at large institutions are more concerned right now about keeping their jobs than funding your transactions, and that's not a criticism, that's just a fact. If they go to credit committee, they want to bring a well-documented, well-put-together deal, so be prepared for that and be ready for that. Don't bring sort of a half-baked deal in and see if you can get it financed. You really get one bite at the apple. So make sure you're well-structured. Remember that there are non-project-related credit impacts out there that exist. GIC income, that's a guaranteed investment contract. When you're investing your construction funds, when you're investing your reserve funds that are required for these types of projects, the reinvestment rates you're receiving now are extraordinarily low. But your interest rate is extraordinarily high. That means you've got a significant amount of negative arbitrage that has a negative impact on your project. There are ways to address that, but it's something that should be factored in as you're structuring your transaction. And finally, I guess with a closing thought that I think relates to all of this, as you're looking at these projects and putting them together, bring your financing partner in early. Don't get caught in the trap of doing what worked last year or even 6 months ago. I think you need to make sure your financing is there from the beginning, that you're getting input from your financing partner so that you're putting together a deal that's going to work and your project's going to get built. Thank you very much.
Peter, thanks very much for that great wrap-up and summary of the current state of the markets. So I think we're open for questions. Why don't I kick it off? As I was listening to the three of you, it occurred to me that you're all talking about the fact that we've had I think the McKinsey folks referred to as a technical break, which was depicted on various of your charts as starting up here and the next second ending up down there, and no explanation other than the fact that it's a whole new world. So my question is, once we reach stasis, what is that new normal going to look like, and how do we get there?
Well, I'll start on this one. I think folks think normal was 2006, 2007, when money was flowing freely. Folks weren't focused on deal structures. I think enough folks have been burned, and a lot of lessons have been learned from that
period of time, that I don't think that is normal. I think the new normal is going to look a lot like where we are now. There's going to continue to be a focus on deal structure. There's going to be continue to be a focus on credit, and I think it's going to continue to be heightened. I think, you know, I think it's over, we're in an overreactive period at the moment, which is understandable, and I think things are going to swing back, but certainly not to where we were in 2006 to 2007.
Well, I'm going to say I'm going to overreact. It's fundamentally, I think this is still pretty good. I think it can get worse, unfortunately. You know, in venture capital, what we saw since 98 was not sustainable. And what we have today with half the funds going out of business next year, the truth is they're already out of business. If you can't write a check, you're a useless VC. And a lot of them can't write a check right now. And the guys who can do financing, they're mothering their loads. They're looking at valuations. Valuations are dropping like a rock. You're seeing higher quality deals. You're seeing better companies come to you at an earlier stage for less money for a better deal. I mean, if my job as an investor is to get outsized returns, I look for the highest quality company at the lowest possible price, and then I squeeze the thumbscrews a little bit more. That's what we get to do now. And it's part of the process. Now, the key point is that you can't expect to see what you saw before happen again, as far as deals, as far as technologies, as far as the type of things that are going to emerge. The good news is, you know, the new normal is going to provide a lot of opportunities. The challenge is, are we still going to be playing under the same old rules that we used to run under? I mean, Jefferson on the memorial, he said that it makes no more sense for a country to use the same laws that it had when it was young. Now, no more than a man should wear the same suit he wore as a boy. Things are going to have to change because the technology is going to change. And you mentioned more technology in the next 10 years than we've had in the past 100. And we did some pretty damn good stuff. I mean, we learned how to fly in the past 100 years. We went to space in the past 100 years. And we're going to outpace that by a factor of 10 in the next 10 years. This is going to be great. But I have no idea what's going to survive. I have no idea what's going to succeed. All I can do is look at the fundamental benefits, the needs, and let the technology win as it's going to win. Because nothing I say, nothing I think or believe is going to stop these guys from doing what they're going to do. Entrepreneurs are fantastic. They're going to ignore everybody on this panel and everyone in this room, and they're going to make the world happen the way they believe it's going to happen.
The only constant is change. Fear and greed rule just like they always have and they always will. Human nature is the same as it was during the boom years and the bust years and so on and so forth, and the new normal is the same as the old normal, no matter what the stock prices say.
Question?
How important, in lieu of the financial crisis, has the government, and not just the U.S. government, the Chinese government, and the EU government, how important has the government's role as an investor in a lot of these technologies and small startup companies become? And would you say it's a substantial increase in their importance since the financial crisis? And do you think that will sustain?
The government has been extremely crucial in everything that they've done. The stimulus package is fantastic for morale, but very little of the stimulus money has actually gotten out into the field yet. And so, you know, as far as useful monies, you know, that's actually getting into people's pockets, we're probably still in the first inning of the ballgame, and maybe not even in the first inning yet. The most important thing that we see in the stimulus package is that the government's willing to finance scale up of manufacturing technologies, which is a wonderful thing. Many investors are not interested in. I'll give you a quick story. Company X wants to go to Boeing to make nanotechnology-based fibers for the airplane, so that the airplanes can run, you know, can be lighter and more fuel efficient. Boeing is very interested in these things and says, we'd like to give you an order. We need you to make these materials 24/7. We need 7 different manufacturing plants located around the country. We need, you know, on-time delivery of everything. And the startup company says, hey, you know, we're scientists with a material here. So no investors want to finance that deal because they don't see the revenues in place today. And only the government can afford to lose that kind of money. And take that kind of risk. And by taking that kind of risk, you create the next generation of manufacturing centers of excellence that'll lead us out of the crisis. And so the government is extremely important, But, you know, it's like the snake swallowing the elephant or whatever it is. You know, it takes a long time to digest and get through the system.
One thing I like about your question is the fact that we're in the global market space. I mean, most of the conversation today has been focused on what's happening in the United States within our domestic borders, and that's the main purpose. But as an investor, we have to be cognizant that there is a huge population out there, and they do have money, and some of them have U.S. dollars, a lot of U.S. dollars. Their solutions are not going to be the same as our solutions here. We have a grid on the electrical system. We enjoy our grid. The Western world has a nice grid. We don't have a grid in Africa. We don't have a reliable grid in India. We don't have a reliable grid in China. And the fact of the matter is the solutions that exist there, the ones that are going to be sold to the base of the pyramid, the ones that are going to be sold to billions of people, are not going to be the solutions that are going to be purchased and used in the United States. So we're seeing a bifurcation in approach from the technology companies as to where do they want to sell, how do they want to sell, and what do they want to sell. Yesterday I read an article on how a solar cell was not being made out of silicon. It was being made with human hair. And what does that do to the cost-benefit analysis of the manufacturing facilities, of the resources, of what is possible in the third world? I mean, the poor deserve as much as we do, light, heat, health. And the idea of we're going to wait until after we get the solution here in the United States before we start attacking that population is falling by the wayside, because they have money and they have resources, and truth is, they pay their bills on time.
And I would just add, just from a different perspective, from sort of a project and debt perspective, you know, you can't forget that the largest user of energy in this country is the federal government. And not particularly as part of the Recovery Act, but the federal government has had programs and a couple of things I was going to talk about. They have existing mandates that date back from really the Energy Policy Act of 1992, as well as EPACT 05, that mandate reduction in energy use within the federal government, which were upped by executive order, as well as renewable goals that they have to meet that are pretty stringent. So the government's been leading the way. And, you know, if you need to finance a credit out there, you know, the government's, we've got large deficits, but it's still the best credit in the world. So those are projects that are financeable, that can get done, and then are getting done, and then are being financed.
Mike?
Peter, the government has financed $6 trillion this year, alone the first 9 months. Are you worried looking ahead about a crowding out effect in terms of the pressure on continuing to finance our shortfalls over the next 2 to 3 years, and what impact that might purposes?
Do you mean the issuance of treasury? Yeah, it's, you know, I the biggest concern revolves around with all that debt out there, whether we're going to have inflationary pressures, which would have a, you know, obviously it's a significant impact across the country that hasn't come to pass. But I think everyone is looking very closely at the Fed to determine whether they should continue issuing at the level they're issuing and buying at the level they're buying, and the Chinese government, whether they're going to continue what they're doing. So I think there is concern overall about the economic impact. You know, what's dragging the economy down right now is us, as consumers. We haven't bought in quite yet. So that's keeping inflationary pressures down. I'm not an economist, but, you know, certainly there's a concern, I think. Investors are starting, as I mentioned, moving away from treasuries into seeking more yield and therefore more risk out there in the debt market. So, you know, the Fed is keeping its eye on it, and we'll have to see how that all plays out.
Looking ahead, switching to let's say that inflation does happen and run this course starting 3 to 5 years. Let's say we see market inflation 5, 7, 8% a year. How does that impact the industry? How does that impact your business model and your plans going forward?
Go ahead.
The stuff that we're doing is not necessarily impacted by inflation because, you know, the iPod is now $120 and it was, you know, the same price performance would have cost you $10 million 5 years ago. So most technologies, you know, most advanced technologies are in a pretty deflationary environment or disinflationary environment, or I'm not an economist either. But you know, we think that if you are looking for higher returns, in order to justify, you know, in a higher interest rate environment. You should, I think it would increase the need to go after breakthrough technologies which can provide that kind of return.
Okay. Last question.
Actually, typically, venture capital funds make multiple investments in companies that they like, first of all. The question that you're asking, I think, is a great one, and I've asked it a few times, saying, should America have a sovereign wealth fund? And the answer is probably no, but I think that it would be a great idea if a couple of states wanted to put together a sovereign wealth fund and become investors, because China is investing in advanced technologies, Russia is investing in nanotechnology. The Middle East is the nanotechnology revolution is the first revolution in my lifetime anyway where it's not assumed that America is the leader. Now, America will lead because the best and the brightest come here and stay here, but I think that there should be large pools of money that try and earn an investment return, and that investment return not only includes, you know, capital but also jobs and critical industries.
The answer is yes. And we've seen this happen before. NSF is one of the marquee ways for government to go out there and seed new technologies. Their SBIR program is, I think, fantastic because there is no explicit goal with any of their grants, unlike the DARPA, DOD, DOE type loans where there isn't a specific assignment for what the technology is going to do. They're looking at black box, open sky type of elements. We do have states and the federal government involved in several funds, acting as LPs, limited partners, investing in the funds for the funds to then invest in technologies. But the one lesson that the government hasn't learned yet, it's not how to put money, more money into a system, it's how to kill off the ones that you don't like. I mean, my numbers are horrible if you were to look them on an absolute basis. Half of the investments that an average VC makes goes to zero. It's a nice round number and we know what it means. Rule of thumb was another three of them are going to return about what you expect, you know, about 5-10%. Another few, actually that's wrong, two are going to return about what you expect. Three of them are going to do essentially living dead. I mean, they don't go to zero, but they don't actually add economic value. They just burn up my time, money, and effort, and they're pretty much useless. I would rather have them go to zero because then I at least get my time back. One deal in early stage VC is going to make the fund. If you're lucky, two. And if you're very lucky, three, but that means you cheated. But those are the ones that get you not double your money back, not three times your money back, 10 times, 50 times. These are the huge ones. And for an industry that's based upon home runs, you've got to keep feeding the ones that have a chance. The government's very good at starting things. The government's very good at keeping things going. But after a while, you start seeing pet projects emerge. We have that problem with foundations. And you can see a lot of good that's being done with several very high profile activities. But the truth is, on an economic basis, they should die. And it's a very hard thing to learn when to tell an entrepreneur and a company and all the employees and all the people who are selling to that company, I'm sorry, the answer is no. You're out of business. You have to find new jobs. That's not something I know any state official has been able to do in my lifetime.
Sure.
Money to invest in the coal plant from day one, you've got a very long time to It's a great question, and I don't really it's hard to answer that question. You know, I guess the way to make the judgment if you're the investor is then in the business model, because the best technologies don't necessarily win. You know, customer acquisition and low cost production and those types of things are, you know, ultimately more important than new technologies. But certainly, you know, the other thing that I would say is certainly you would want to be an acquirer of new technologies if you're a company. So, you know, a great example is Cisco, which is, you know, one of the biggest companies in America. Well, Cisco in the 90s probably made about 400 acquisitions. The Cisco that came public and originally started was not the Cisco of today. They didn't have one widget that took over the world. They acquired every widget that they could find using their stock as equity mostly. And so not only do you need good new technologies and the ability to embrace new technologies, but you also need very solid business plans and market strategies, very strong management teams, you know, all the basics of the basic blocking and tackling of business doesn't change just because we're in a new technology paradigm. And so, you know, it's a very hard question, but, you know, for management with vision and foresight is probably, you know, the most important thing.
It takes a bit of courage. I went to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, and that's a steel city town. But Andrew Carnegie actually shut down one of his plants before it even opened up, because this was around the time he bought the Bessemer steel process. Before that, he was heat treating the steel twice, which was an inefficient process. Bessemer was a much better one. So he actually went through and said, there's no reason for this plant to exist. Shut it down before it even started and switched over to the new process. And it takes courage to do that. It's a hard job, and we don't see that type of ability in current CFOs because they're being measured on a quarterly basis. But if you're running a company for your own purposes with a long-term horizon and a long-term capability, you make the best decisions for the business itself. That's another discussion on our quarterly focus. But the truth is we can see it happen in certain industries, and we have seen it happen already.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking our panel. The last item on the agenda. The last item on the agenda calls for closing remarks, which I intend to do in 60 seconds or less, to not keep you from the reception. But I think it's important to maybe just revisit a couple of the topics that we've hit today, because I certainly think we've covered a lot of ground, and hopefully it's been as interesting for you as it has been for me. We started out talking about transmission issues and how transmission is coming to the forefront. We moved on from there to how renewable resources fit in and into the mix of resource planning, the different kinds of resources we have, and we left some open questions as to how those resources are going to be measured one against the other. We talked a little bit about regulation and policy. Is it more bottom-up from the states to the federal, or top-down from the federal to the states? And I think on that point, we got sort of a mixed response. There are good reasons to do both, and probably we will continue to do both. We talked about solicitations and how RPS and RES may affect the mini markets that effectively take place each time a utility goes out to solicit proposals, whether it's renewable energy or traditional energy. A key theme throughout the day is technology, and I'm glad that our speakers on this panel really brought that home. Technology is the game changer. The whole world can change tomorrow with the development of one new major technology that changes the rules of the game. And, of course, we got to our final panel here where, as I said, where the rubber hits the road, and you got, I think, a very concise and candid sense of sort of the brass tacks of how investors look at investments in general and the renewable energy space in specific. We've got the Dr. Kevorkian School of venture capital on one end. We've got IPO, you know, the IPO crisis and prospects that have been going on for the past few years. And, of course, Peter finished up by talking about the general environment for project structuring and financing. So you see that we really have covered a lot of ground today. I'm very grateful for all the speakers, not only on this panel, but the other panels that were able to join us today. And I want to thank you, particularly the folks who are here, who stuck it out through the day and contributed so well with your questions and comments. So please give yourselves and the panels a round of applause and join us in the reception. And thank you for coming.